I've gotten a number of wonderful comments about how valuable you feel this conference has been in so many ways. And I think that my cousin Caroline really said it best when she said, we got to lean forward and think about the future. And that was the moniker of her father's presidency, was to always think to the future. And I honestly want to tell you, as much as Garen and I have done to try to bring this all together, we really would not have been able to do it. And I know everybody in this room who's here understands of what I'm talking about. Without the amazing perseverance and persistence and leadership and the integrity to back it up, so that when he calls, everybody is in a position where there's no other answer but yes. And when people ask me, how is it that you could put so many people from diverse backgrounds in the field of neuroscience together in one room, I say simply it's because of Steve Hyman. And when anybody thinks about what their life has been part of doing, all of what you do, as I said before, is incredibly important in so many ways that have been articulated up to this point so beautifully. But to have an opportunity at one point in one's life to really make a fundamental difference, and to do it in such a dramatic way as the way that Steve has brought all of his colleagues together to map out the first ever combined roadmap that is the roadmap for all brain disorders is really no small feat. And the ability to do that was really an ability based upon the integrity that he had and the respect that he enjoyed amongst all of his colleagues. And because we're doing this around the amazing moniker of President Kennedy's famous moonshot speech, I thought it only appropriate to use an inscription in a bust of President Kennedy to describe what this has been all about and to present it to Steve. And I wanted to do it now, and I wanted, Steve, if you could come up. And in this inscription, it says, quote, we do these things not because they're easy, but because they're hard. And I will tell you, there's probably no bigger job than to bring everybody together. And this man, Steve Hyman's been the guy that's got it done. Thank you, Steve. I wanted to do it while
all right.
Here.
Well, Patrick, you give me far too much credit, but I'm really moved, and that is absolutely beautiful. But of course, everybody knows here that this symposium and the documents are the work of many, many hands. And it's been a privilege to begin this process. And now, together, we're all going to follow through. So thank you very much.
Thank you. I want to also take this opportunity to introduce somebody whose very reputation has been a source of inspiration, just like my uncle. And in the work of people across this country who have been affected by war, the name Max Cleland is a name that unites everybody. Because Max is the story of the American hero who is willing to go beyond what any of us could ever imagine. And that is to devote ourselves to something much bigger than ourselves and to do the ultimate. And that's to be prepared to lay down our lives for that goal. His goal was to serve this great country of ours. And everybody knows that Max Cleland did so not only honorably in the service of our country in uniform, but he's done so repeatedly in everything that he's done since he's returned home from the Vietnam War. I know for not only all veterans, but all Americans, that we're humbled, Max, by your presence here today and the message you have for all of us about why this effort is so fundamental to saving your friends and colleagues who are serving in uniform from being prisoners of their war injuries. Max Cleland, you're an American hero. You know it because there are millions that are counting on you and you've never let them down. I love you, man, and thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Max. We're actually a little out of sequence, but that usually happens with Patrick. So we are going to have the presentation first with Dr. Hoberg and then to the panel on war, and it would be wrong to not do it in the sequence. So if you could hold your comments for just a minute, Senator, we'd appreciate it very much. So I'm pleased to introduce Lee Hoberg, MD, PhD, a professor of engineering, to show and demonstrate the importance of this cross-industry collaboration that we're going to need to attack this by being of one mind. He's going to talk about BrainGate, neural interfaces toward the restoration of communication and mobility. Please welcome Lee Hochberg. Thank you.
Well, I've now delayed the comments of Max Cleland. That can't possibly be a good way to start. Well, let's see, and I'm just going to toggle our audio, which we can hear very good. Well, it's a real pleasure to be here, and I want to thank Patrick Kennedy and Steve Hyman and the rest of the committee and Ann Young for not only inviting me to be here, it's a true privilege, but for putting together what I'm sure we all would agree is an extraordinary forum and what will continue to be tomorrow and the next day. What I'm going to describe is, I think in reference to one of our prior speakers, a truly embryonic field, that of the development of brain-computer interfaces to try to help people who have lost for any number of reasons their communication or their mobility. This is truly a multi-institutional collaboration, an international collaboration as well, and I'll describe some of those institutions and countries as I go forward. Some of the collaborations and extraordinary people I get to work with every day are up on the screen, including John Donahue, Director of the Institute for Brain Science at Brown University, my colleagues at Mass General and Harvard Medical School, as well as at Brown, the Department of Veterans Affairs and the Rehabilitation Research and Development Service, and elsewhere, including the Cleveland VA and Case Western Reserve University. What I'm going to tell you about, much like a lot of the research we've heard, requires truly a multidisciplinary endeavor from folks from computer science, neuroscience, neurology, engineering, and other disciplines. I am the sponsor investigator of an ongoing pilot clinical trial, so it's important that I measure or that I mention my financial disclosures. I recognize there are some people from industry here, so if anybody can help me solve that, it would be nice. Some of the research was sponsored by a company no longer in existence, CyberKinetics. I do want to thank the several institutes of the National Institutes of Health that continue to support various aspects of this research, as well as the Department of Veterans Affairs and private philanthropy and the Department of Defense that I'll refer to later as well. I spend some of my time as a stroke and critical care neurologist here in Boston at Mass General and Brigham, so it's useful for me to begin with a clinical vignette. In 1996, there was a 42-year-old woman with no significant past medical history who was sitting on her couch watching television with her son when suddenly she couldn't move the right side of her body, and then she couldn't move the left side of her body, and then she couldn't speak. For those that are familiar with this image, it will jump out. For those that are not, this is various images of a person's brain, obviously. Gray is good and white is bad. This is one of the early diffusion-weighted images showing an acute stroke. Most of her brain is gray, but there's one part of it that's bright white, that being right in the center of the brainstem and the pons. She became, at that moment, what's known as locked in, awake, alert, but unable to move, unable to speak, but completely aware of her surroundings. The same condition as Jean-Dominique Balbi, the French editor of Elle, who wrote One Eye Blink at a Time, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, and the subsequent beautiful movie. It's for people like her that we're hoping to develop technologies that will restore the ability to communicate and the ability to move, and for people who perhaps are not quite as physically impaired as she is as well. And I'll come back and I'll tell you a little bit more about her in just a little while. To jump way ahead, we all like our research to be peer-reviewed, and there was a peer review of this field back in 2008 that I think shares some of the excitement, and I'll share that with you.
Once in a while, we run across a science story that's hard to believe until you see it. That's how we felt about this story when we first saw human beings operating computers, writing emails, and driving wheelchairs with nothing but their thoughts. Quietly, in a number of laboratories, an astounding technology is developing that directly connects the human brain to a computer. It's like a sudden leap in human evolution. A leap that could one day help paralyzed people to walk again and amputees to move bionic limbs. As you will see tonight, the connection has already been made for a few people, and for them, it has been life-changing.
Thank you, Scott. Yeah. If you go to the Merriam-Webster Online Dictionary and look up hyperbole and click, that's the video that appears. I think that some of the excitement that he was capturing, and I'll now show you some of the things that led him to those statements, is really present in this emerging field of brain-computer interfaces, and not what we've achieved for anybody today, but for what we hope to achieve for people with various forms of paralysis, communication, disabilities, and other forms of neurologic injury and disease. Let me take just a step back and introduce you to this gentleman here. He's going to be controlling a cursor on the computer screen. There are some little icons up there for power on and off, channel on and off, and volume. He'll be getting some cues, and he'll be basically using that cursor to control the channel and power on his television. He's been asked to move it up, and he moves that little cursor over to the channel button, changing Dr. Phil to the next channel. Video is when he the gentleman in this video was about 25 when we shot the video. When he was 21, he was breaking up a fight after a football game, was stabbed in the back of the neck, had a C4 ASIA A spinal cord injury, and had been unable to move his arms or his legs since then. He was, however, able to control that cursor on the computer screen in order to change the channel up there, and there's a small hint for how he was doing that, which is the little gray box that's protruding up from the top of his head. He was essentially thinking about the movement of his own hand, which allowed him to control that cursor on the computer screen much as if he had had a computer mouse in his hand. And I'll now take several steps back in order to describe how he did this, and I'll tell you a little bit more about him in just a little while. He was the first participant in our ongoing BrainGate pilot clinical trial using a neural interface system or a brain-computer interface or a brain-machine interface that we'll hear more about as well tomorrow. And all of these systems, regardless of their moniker, are those that permit the direct, real-time, cerebral neural control over an external device. The ability to control something simply by thinking about the movement, for example, of one's own hand. And the goal of these devices, and for that matter, the goal of all neurorehabilitation, is to restore the communication, mobility, and independence of people with severe paralysis or with limb loss. Why do we need these? Certainly don't need to review this slide for the people who are here today. There are any number of diseases or injuries that result in an inability to move or an inability sometimes to communicate as well, while leaving cognition largely intact. And important to mention that the assistive technologies that we have available today to help people with any of these conditions are really only modestly effective at best. If we think about the brain in cartoon form for just a moment, the desire to move begins somewhere in the brain, finds its way down through the brainstem and our spinal cord, and eventually movement or speech is the result. Any number of these diseases results in the equivalent of this red X interrupting the pathway from brain down to effector, whether it's limb or the muscles of articulation. A lot of great research, some of which we've heard about today, is focused right on that red X, curing the disease, curing the lesion at its site. But another approach is to look to these signals that are still trying to get out of the brain, these signals that still desire to move or to drive movement of the limb, to take those signals out of the brain and allow those signals to become useful again, re-enabling the ability to turn thought, if you will, back into action. There are lots of different types of brain-computer interfaces. I'm going to try to provide a schematic that summarizes all of them. These are how we think about these BCIs, which is the current lingo at the bench. They all have three components: a neural sensor, a decoder, and an assistive technology. And since I'm a neurologist, that's the iconic view of a person to me. That person is up there. That is a person who's trying to move but may not be able to for any number of reasons. And our job is to try to extract that intention or that plan to move. There's a few important questions that we have to answer in order to do that. The first is, what signal do we want to record? We've heard about a number of signals in this forum already: electrical signals, magnetic signals, certainly neurotransmitters, chemical signals, and others. So we have to choose one of them, or maybe more than one of them, and stick with it. We have to decide what area of the brain we're interested in recording from, or areas, plural. If we take a happy, healthy monkey and ask that monkey to reach out and grab a peanut, there are at least a dozen different areas of the brain, of the cortex, that are involved in the generation of that voluntary movement in a person. Do we want to record from all of them? Do we want to record from one of them? These are all questions that we have to answer while we're sitting at the bench designing one of these systems. And with the answer to those two questions, we can then begin to decide what type of sensor we want to record with. Do we want to use a functional MRI? Do we want to use scalp electrodes for electroencephalography, or the particular sensor that I'll tell you about in just a moment? Regardless of how you get there, you then take all of this information, which hopefully encodes the plan for movement, and put it into the black box. And this black box is the home of my friends in computational neuroscience, whose job it is to take this complex signal or group of signals out of the brain and in real time turn them back into some useful activity. We describe that as building either a filter or building a decoder. That is, some computer program that can take this powerful neural activity that used to drive movement and once again allow it to drive some external device. Before we're done leaving our bench, though, and designing one of these systems, we do have to decide what we want to do with these systems. For a woman whose MRI I showed you, who's unable to move and unable to speak, if we could restore the ability to type on a computer screen or to browse the web for entertainment or education, those would all be incredibly helpful to her quality of life. For the gentleman with the cervical spinal cord injury who can speak but who's unable to move his arms or his legs, if we could restore better control over his wheelchair, perhaps develop semi-autonomous robots that would help with activities of daily living, these have all been proposed. For people who have lost one or more limbs due to trauma or vascular disease, there are some phenomenal prosthetic limbs that I'll refer to again later that have been developed over the past 5 to 10 years. They, however, still have fairly simple control systems, and wouldn't it be wonderful if we could restore full dexterous movement really at the speed and at the ease of thought, the same thought that I'm using to randomly wave my laser pointer around to drive one of those prosthetic limbs. Or perhaps for somebody with paralysis to control a robotic limb that would allow them to manipulate their environment more easily. The real dream for the research, though, for somebody with spinal cord injury or brainstem stroke, is to one day reconnect brain to limb, to take these signals out of the brain, to send them back down through either the spinal cord or the peripheral nerves, and through functional electrical stimulation, allow that person to reach out and pick up that coffee cup again and bring it to their mouth. And if we have a few moments at the end, I'll also refer to some other potentials for these technologies to help us in the neuro ICU, where I spend some of my time to better understand epilepsy and to get new insights into neuropsychiatric disease. The sensor that I'll be telling you about today, and one that's allowed us to make some great progress recently, us meaning the scientific community, is what used to be known as the Utah Array, further developed by John Donahue and his colleagues at Brown, has had a few other names. But basically, this is a 4x4 millimeter platform, a tiny array of electrodes about the size of the quarter of a nail on your little finger. Each of those electrodes can record from the basic neural element, a neuron in cortex. So we have the potential to record from dozens or hundreds of neurons in cortex simultaneously and to listen to their activities. How do we get that into the brain? Well, we make a small hole or a craniotomy in the brain. We drop the array in, we put a little piece of bone back, and we seal everything up with some titanium, put the skin back, and we're done. Are there any neurosurgeons here? I can get away with that then. Good. What we're left with, at least at the current state of the technology, is this array connected by some fine wires to a pedestal. So whenever, whether it's in the laboratory with animals or more recently in our pilot clinical trial, whenever we want to record from these dozens or hundred or more neural cells, that is neurons in the cortex, we take a medium-sized plug, put it into this pedestal, and continue our recording. In the interest of time, I'm going to summarize about 4.5 decades of science on a Post-it note. We've been able to, through single electrode neurophysiology, learn an extraordinary amount about at least one part of the brain, the primary motor cortex, and how individual neurons in the motor cortex and their firing patterns relate to various parameters of the control of movement. For example, it's not much of a surprise that the motor cortex is very important for the control of voluntary movement. Some neurons will fire more if there's more force being placed, perhaps by my hand on this laser pointer, and these other very important variables as well. These are all things that have been studied closely and parameters that have been elaborated and elucidated by people like John Donahue, by Andy Schwartz as well, who we'll hear from tomorrow, and others. And this up here in the corner is just a reminder for me to say out loud of the multitude of neural signals that we could record from just one of these arrays, not just the action potentials, which in many ways are the language of the nervous system. These are how neurons communicate with neurons. Neurons communicate, as many of you know, with muscles. But also the local field potentials, the multi-unit activity, all of which can be recorded simultaneously. And it's that 40-plus years of basic science, largely funded by the National Institutes of Health and the Department of Veterans Affairs, that we're now able to translate to pilot clinical trials, showing yet again the importance of fundamental research into the motor system now being hopefully put to good use to help people with various neurologic diseases and injuries. So with that post-it note, we've skipped through about 40 years, and we've gotten to the point of a pilot clinical trial of this device placed into the motor cortex, asking the simple question of whether it's feasible for somebody with tetraplegia, that is, whether it's feasible for somebody who can't move their arms or legs, to control a cursor on a computer screen simply by thinking about the movement of their own hand. And based on all that fundamental research we're recording from the cortex of people who enroll in our trial, translating those signals through through simple computers that are decoding that activity and hopefully allowing them to control external devices. I'd like to show you just a few videos of some of the participants doing that. We began to report this. Some of these are now historical videos. Here's our first participant again, who's the gentleman with cervical spinal cord injury. You'll hear him speaking while he's using essentially a simulated email program, thinking about the movement of his own paralyzed hand and driving this cursor on the computer screen.
Okay, so here's the CyberKinetics desktop. What are you going to do first?
I'm going to open my email first.
Okay.
So here he just drags the neural cursor, as we'll call it, across one of the icons in order to open up the next email.
Congratulations, you are doing a great job.
Very good.
I'm going to open the second email.
Okay.
It says, hi, but we'll talk soon.
Great. Now, can you exit back to the CyberKinetics desktop?
Because of his injury, he hadn't been able to draw for a few years. So we presented him with what's essentially an old version of Mac Paint. We wanted to give him the ability to try to draw again. So this is an eraser up at the top and an inkwell down at the bottom, and he'll try to draw a circle. It wasn't a circle on his first attempt, so we'll try it again. It's also not a circle, but he notices that there's an obstacle there, and he avoids it. We asked him to try to do some other things for about 8 minutes, and then we asked him to come back to try to draw the circle again.
All right. Excellent.
And he goes out of his way to complete the circle just to prove to us that that he could do it.
Very good.
I'll show you some other examples of physical device or virtual devices being controlled, but here's one example of a physical device. This is a prosthetic limb for distal upper extremity amputation. Our participant's going to say out loud, open and close, so that we know what he's trying to do. And depending on the audio, you may hear his, I guess, colorful reaction to his initial ability to do this. The audio was sufficiently quiet, so you missed the expletive, but nevertheless, he was pleased at his ability to do this as he was looking down at the hand, saying open and close, and quite readily able to control that one-dimensional movement. Another audio and video to show you is, if we go back to our woman with locked-in syndrome who can't move her limbs, who can't speak, we ask her to try to open and close her hand while we're listening to some of these cells in the cortex. So what you see on the screen are the amplified action potentials from just one of these 100 electrodes.
Open your hand.
And that staccato rat-a-tat-tat in the background is an action potential firing away as she tries to open her hand, which is something she can't do. These are cells that are acting probably much the same way as they did before her injury, which at this point is more than a decade earlier. These are cells that quite clearly we can decode. We know what those cells are trying to do. And if we can take those neural activities and convert them to the control of an external device, we would be able to restore her ability, we hope, to control a cursor on a computer screen and other technologies as well. So let me show you a little bit more of her doing that. So now we're 13 plus years after her stroke. We asked her if she has any messages that she'd like to share with other people who have paralysis. And here we've given her a simple QWERTY keyboard, and very tiny on there is the standard Windows cursor that's being used not just to point at the letter of interest, but to point and click. So she's imagining moving her hand or attempting to move her hand. When she gets to the letter of interest, she pauses on it, and she imagines squeezing her hand, much like somebody who is used without a physical disability who has their hand on a computer mouse and clicks the button. And slowly, for sure, but surely, she'll type out a message that that she wants to share with others. This could be sped up a bit with some word prediction, which is part of what she uses here, and I'll show you a bit more of that in just a moment. And so she, on her own, wanted to share this important message that there is hope. I'll show here, just again briefly, without going through the whole thing, that she is again using this point-and-click control over a typical Windows operating system. This, we believe, is the world's first ever brain-computer interface, Google Chat, where she's using this point-and-click interface and interacting with one of our lab techs about 30 miles away. She's the me up there saying hi. Sergey is now a grad student at Stanford who says, after being surprised to get this text message from her or this GChat message, hello, how are you? And they continue to have this conversation. I was asked to make sure, in the interest of time, we speed up a bit, so I'm going to skip through just a little bit. The videos that I've shown you so far, this is a standard QWERTY keyboard intended for people with two hands and five fingers each. We're also developing a neural interface system that will take better advantage of the control system we've given her so far. So this is a radial keyboard. What she's doing is going to the letter of interest and clicking again, and we asked her to send a message before last year's Society for Neuroscience meeting. And so here she's slowly but surely typing out one letter at a time. On the right, there's a word prediction that's continually evolving. And when the word of interest appears, she selects the words that are over in that green section and then subsequently clicks. I point out that she had the opportunity to say hi to everybody at the Society for Neurosis. She thankfully didn't pick that one. She's then going to tell us that cinnamon is her favorite type of coffee. I'll move on. Controlling virtual devices is quite helpful, but we also want to re-enable the ability to control physical devices. Here is our participant with her face grayed out interacting with me using a translucent eye board. She's looking at an individual letter. I'm saying that letter out loud. If it's the right letter, she looks up, which is how I know it's the right letter, and that's how she usually communicates. But what she's going to be doing here is controlling that robotic arm simply by thinking about the movement of her own hand. There's the lower half of John Donahue who just asked her to open and close that hand a few times, which she'll do. We'll move on to a one-dimensional movement here. She's going to think about moving her own arm down closer to the table. And that robot arm responds accordingly. I'll skip through this one, so she's not able to do it quite this fast, but she picks up that bottle. This is 1.5 dimensions of movement where she was moving in one direction. She also has the open and close control of that bottle, and she's then going to release the hand, which allows the arm to drop, not under her control, under pre-programmed control. And here we'll get to 2.5 dimensions where she's picking up this wine glass. It lifts up, again, under pre-programmed control, but she's moving it in the X and Y dimension. She's going to bring that glass close to her over to the blue dot. And because I only recruit compulsive participants for a research study, she doesn't exactly like where she's placed this glass, so she's going to go back and fix it and put it a little bit closer to where she wanted it the first time. This is something that she was able to do just within a matter of days of being introduced to that robotic arm. A quick summary of some of the research that's going on, not just in our BrainGate labs, but throughout the country in these brain-computer interfaces. First, there's an ongoing neuroengineering effort to develop fully implanted systems, much like deep brain stimulators that we'll hear more about later and tomorrow, to be able to record this extremely powerful signal from the cortex, not just from one place in the brain, but from multiple places in the brain, that being led by Artur Nirmico and our group over at engineering at Brown University. I told you a little bit about the communication and the assistive technologies. The control over these incredible advanced prosthetic limbs that have been developed largely through the leadership of people like Colonel Jeffrey Ling at the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, together with collaborators in industry and the Department of Veterans Affairs, working together to develop these technologies and now to test them in feasibility studies. And what we hope is, together with our colleagues at Cleveland VA, is to be able to one day reconnect brain to limb, and recently accepted paper of being able to control a dynamic limb, that is one that changes much like a person's own limb does as they're moving from one place to another. As just one last thought, while I've talked about neurorehabilitation and the promise of this technology, what we're essentially doing is we're recording neural activity and we're beginning to predict neural activity from neural activity. And just to show you a moment of my good friend and colleague's work, Sid Cash at MGH and Wilson Trucolo at Brown, they're beginning to record from the cortex of people who are already in the hospital having surgical monitoring for epilepsy done using this highly resolute signal of an implanted array. And here's an example of just one neuron ticking away over an hour or so. The number of action potentials per second being recorded, and this red line that you see is the beginning of the electrographic seizure. And here we are about 25 minutes ahead of time with a neuron that seems to be increasing its firing rate well in advance of that electrographic seizure, suggesting that perhaps with these advanced neurostatistical techniques and neural recording techniques, we'll get a whole new insight into this disease of pathologic synchrony, that is of epilepsy, and hopefully be able to use that those same insights to better understand how to treat people with traumatic brain injury who are in the neuro ICU and get some additional insights into the incredibly complex neuropsychiatric disorders as well. And with that, I'll just put up some of the group hard at work on hopefully restoring communication, mobility, and independence to people with paralysis, and we'll hear more about this from Andy Schwartz tomorrow. Thanks very much.